Howdy, folks. Rob Wolf here. Six listeners can't be wrong. This is the Paleo Solution Podcast, and I am incredibly excited to have our guest today. She is a primitive skills expert, an alumni of the wildly successful and popular Naked and Afraid show, Laura Zara. Laura, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Rob. Thanks for having me on. I'm really excited.
I am so excited for this. And, you know, just getting the podcast going is kind of, it's maybe allegorical for the fact that we should not rely on technology because it was a pain in the ass getting this thing going.
So. Throw me out in the backcountry anywhere, I'm good. You try to get me to use technology and it's just a big fail.
Don't go there. Don't go there. It's just sorrow and pain and suffering and all that stuff. So, hey, let me do our podcast sponsors really quick, get that stuff out of the way, and then we will talk about you and all of your shenanigans. So folks should check out frontdeskhq.com. Front Desk is your mobile-based solution for service-based businesses, CrossFit and dog walking, Pilates-ing, yoga-ing, anything that's got an ing in it and is service-based. You want to check out frontdeskhq.com. Well Food Co. is your place to go for grass-fed jerky, all kinds of almond-based cookies and snacks. We've got some keto and some non-keto MRE-type replacements that are all gluten-free and pretty solid. Go to wellfoodco.com. Performance Menu, the Journal of Nutrition and Athletic Excellence, performancemenu.com. You've got a $30 and $100 buy-in on that. The $30 gets you all the current issues in a variety of formats. $100 gets you all of the back issues, plus 15% off in the Catalyst Athletic Store. MasaNaturalMeats.com. Masa Meats are the folks that I get my meat from. They're outside of Orland, California. Phenomenal people, really good quality products that they have. They have both grass-fed meat or beef and lamb, and I think they may be doing some goat here soon, which will be amazing. And then finally, Hylete.com. I was an early adopter on the athletic brand Hylete. Really, really good for any of your workout-type activities. Use the discount code RW25 and receive a 25% discount on that. Okay, that bullshit's out of the way. Let's talk about you. So, Laura, you have a really amazing bio. Can you give folks a little bit of your background? Like, I could just read it off of your site, and it would probably be somewhat amazing, but you talking about it would be far more amazing because you've got a hell of a story.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things where I never really know where to start. I feel like a lot has happened in my 28 years. For the past 10, they've been the more interesting ones. I had a childhood that I spent a lot of time in the woods, but it really started to get crazy about 10 years ago. I kind of hit the road, started traveling all over the place, putting myself in different survival situations, in new places. That was the big thing. Experiencing places I wasn't familiar with, because that always made me push my limits on what I thought I knew. And picking up all sorts of funny odd jobs along the way, from, you know, being a butcher and a taxidermist to as a former vegan, which I think most people find interesting. Then going, you know, doing some mushroom hunting out in Oregon, going to I did a little bit of offshore crabbing. I mean, I don't like to be bored. So I've kind of kept it interesting.
Well, you know, most people, particularly you, are absolutely gorgeous. You're clearly very smart. what compels a young woman like you, you know, to keep from getting bored? Usually that's like go to an urban center, do clubbing, find some sort of corporate job to climb. It doesn't involve, scavenging roadkill from the side of the road to start creating hats and suits out of them. Like, what was that process? I mean, what drove you in that direction?
I mean, I think, you know, it's kind of been the question of my life. Why? But really, it started out with me wanting this deeper connection to land and to place, and also to feel like I have ultimate freedom. So I'm not connected and tied into certain people or certain resources, like knowing that I can meet my own basic needs. That's kind of what drove me into survival. It wasn't about surviving the zombie apocalypse. Quite frankly, if there's a zombie apocalypse, I kind of want to be one of the first ones to go. I'm not interested. But it's about having that freedom. Like, when I know what my needs are, I can meet them. And I like going out into wild places. And so it was kind of natural for me to learn how to exist there without needing, you know, the latest gear or the fanciest tent or the latest and dehydrated food. I wanted to have connection to my own food So yeah, I kind of spiraled out of control and led me to where I am now.
Or wildly in control, one or the other, depending on how you look at it.
So, right.
You know, I think it's really, it's interesting to me anyway, that in this kind of paleo ancestral health scene, I would say one of the largest groups of folks who kind of migrate this direction are actually former vegans. And, you know, I think that people look at the both ways of eating as you know, some potential benefits for health and whatnot. But I think that there's also a deep sense of kind of impact that we leave throughout our lifetime on the world around us and, you know, some accountability based around that. And you know, what do you think about that? And, you know, what kind of, you know, I don't want to ask too leading of a question, but, you know, what led into the veganism? And then, you know, how did you proceed out of that? Like, what was the process of changing out of that and kind of recognizing this interplay, you know, cycle of life, Lion King type deal, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of people wonder that. And really, I started being a vegan because I really loved meat and I looked into where it came from, which was a big mistake. When I found out, I was obviously horrified. The whole factory farming system. I mean, I was still pretty young at the time. So yeah, it was just absolutely horrific. And I cut all the meat out. And then I realized that by not, you know, by still having dairy products and by still eating eggs and such, I was still supporting that system. So I cut everything out. Well, I started eating a lot of soy and stuff like that. And the more I thought about it, the more I traveled, the more I saw where my food was grown, I realized that, you know, I grew up in New England, and if I'm eating a mango in the middle of the winter, there was obviously a pretty big impact that mango had to get to me. The soy farms in South America, Central America were devastating. I mean, just the amount of deforestation. Furthermore, the way my body felt, I didn't feel good. And I didn't realize how bad I felt until I ate my first piece of meat. And that kind of came about because I always said if I could get a piece of meat that I felt good about eating, I would have no problem eating it. Well, all of a sudden this roadkill deer comes along and I take my first bite and everyone tells me, oh, you're going to get so sick. You haven't eaten meat in forever, but I'm a human. My body doesn't forget how to digest meat just because it's been a number of years. And not only did I not get sick, I felt absolutely incredible. I felt, you know, I think I was 18 when I started eating meat again. And I thought that I just didn't have energy because, oh, I must be getting old. Totally ridiculous. And then it became apparent that for me to be healthy personally, I needed meat in my diet. That was important to me, but I needed to feel good about where my meat came from. So that's how I started eating roadkill, because I felt like, you know, it was something that was going to go to waste anyway. The sacrifice had already been made. Why not make use of it? And then that led to me wanting to have this connection to what I was eating. If there wasn't a roadkill deer on the highway, what was I going to do? Was I going to go back to eating soy and thinking about how many deer my tofu truck took to get hit on the way to get to me? Was I going to start hunting? And that kind of was a game changer for me, because looking an animal in the eye and deciding that I was going to take its life and that my life was worth taking that animal's life, it was a really powerful motivator for me, because it made me realize I had to make my life worth it. You know, I couldn't just decide that my life was worth killing other creatures for if, you know, all I did was lay around and watch TV and, you know, do nothing with myself.
So. I mean, it's a gut check taking a really beautiful animal and, like you said, looking it in the eye and taken its life. And I think that when you do that too, like the inclination to just simply look for T-bones and loins and stuff like that kind of goes out the window.
Absolutely. When
I have an animal processed, I still have not fully done one myself at home, but so I still hand this off to be processed, and the processors are shocked because I want everything. The intestines, the giblets, the shanks. I mean, they're kind of like, wow, I usually feed most of this to my dogs. And I'm like, well, that's good, but I'm going to eat that stuff. So, I mean, it's an entirely different approach to that. But I still think even people in the ancestral health scene, I'm sure that you will get some resonance with some people, but we have such a cultural aversion to thinking about, like, grabbing something that was hit on the side of the road and eating it. But that totally makes sense. I mean, it completely makes sense. But that it's just so fascinating that the process with that. Have you ever done like a Myers-Briggs personality test?
I haven't.
That would be interesting to see where you play out on all that stuff.
I
That'd
don't
be
know if
interesting.
I want to
It's kind of, for me, it was I never really I was reasonably popular in high school, reasonably popular in college. Like people liked me, I'm affable and everything, but I never quite fit in. Like I'm always a little bit of the odd duck out, and ancestral health, I seem to be like a pig in shit because everybody else is kind of goofy too. So I think it's good in that regard, but it'd be interesting to see where your personality kind of profile plays out on that. So, you started thinking about hunting. What was the process of actually taking some action in that direction?
It was intense. Going out with people I knew that hunted. I was going out and taking part and helping them track animals. That's kind of how it first happened, is I wanted to know that if I shot something, I didn't get caught up in the heat of the moment. I wanted to know that I could still be focused and aware on the tracking part. So I started tracking injured deer and then finding them, and occasionally, having to finish things off when I found them if they weren't quite there. And it was really intense. It was very intense. And then going out in certain survival situations, and it's just this in really intense gratitude. I think that's what surprised me most, is that I was very fearful of the killing part of things, because you never know where you're going to be with that until you're doing it. And I think that was the overwhelming feeling I had. It was gratitude, and just especially when you really need it, it's pretty humbling to go through with taking something's life. I hope that
Absolutely.
never changes.
Yeah. No, that totally makes sense. So when did you first start going out on your own then and doing some hunting, and what was the method that you used? Like, I know you have some skills in making your own bows. Did you start with that? Did you start with a rifle? Like, how did you do that? Or what was the kind of technology process in that whole story?
So I first started out going out, and I would just have my knife, and that's when I was still doing tracking. It kind of How I first started killing things was actually in survival situations, using a throwing stick. And that's intense. A lot more failure than success, certainly at the start. I still do not have the best arm. That's probably one of my biggest weaknesses. But trial and error for sure. I'm definitely not opposed to hunting with a rifle. I do rifle hunt. I also make my own bows and go hunting with them. It's one of those things where if I am not practicing 100% consistently with my bow, I'm not going to go and point at anything, because having witnessed several archery hunts gone awry, I never want to be in that position. It's just not a good feeling, wounding something terribly, and knowing that it lived and suffered for at least another week. It's like I never want to do that.
Right.
So I have no problems with the rifle. I want to actually get more up with the atlatl. That's kind of a dream of mine. Is I'm headed to Australia at the end of April, and I don't know. I got to look into their laws. A kangaroo with an atlatl, that's kind of a dream of
That
mine.
would be legit.
Yeah,
Well,
absolutely.
you come stay with us in Reno and I can get you. I still practice with the atlatl probably at least once a week. So I don't use the traditional darts for the practice. I actually use some stuff that is very similar to kind of fiberglass tent stakes. So they have a lot of the same characteristics and the same kind of spining activity. But
Absolutely.
I can flub a ton of throws and have them go in the weeds and the rocks and stuff, and they don't
Yep.
shatter. So
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
yeah.
That's awesome. I'm totally going to take you up on that.
Open invite anytime you want to do it. Just get here before the baby arrives. Otherwise, it'll be complete chaos. So
Absolutely.
when you're building a bow, what's the process with that? Like my good friend Billy Berger also on the Naked and Afraid show, which after the beating that I took on iCaveman, I was like, I'm not doing this stuff anymore. And he actually got in and did the Louisiana Bayou, which, I mean, out of any of the shows that I've seen, Everybody has had a rough time, but honestly, I think that that was about the roughest one that I've seen because
Oh,
they
I
had
felt so bad for them.
trench foot and they were freezing and they were basically, you know, in ankle deep water the whole time. But you know, Billy starts with basically a, you know, whether he's using yew wood or orange wood or whatever, like he starts with a shank of wood and starts working it. He makes the cordage from like tendon out of animals that he's gotten from previous hunts. Like what's your process in making it, say, like a bow and arrow setup?
First of all, I just want to say that Billy's a total badass.
He's amazing. I love that guy.
He's awesome. I really like Billy. Yeah, I mean, same process. What I love about it is that you really have to listen to the piece of wood. You can go in there with whatever idea you think you have about what kind of bow you want to build, but at the end of the day, if you don't listen to the type of wood, if you don't listen to that exact piece of wood and how it grew, you're going to have a blow up in your face. So it's really an interesting, I mean, it's something that, you know, if you're just going into it because you want the final product, you're probably not going to be a good bowyer. It's all about the process. There's countless hours that I have invested in all the bows I've built. And it's really, for me, just kind of almost a meditation, you know, listening. All right, I think you're there.
We're back. Okay, cool. Clearly the technology gods are pissed at a couple of Luddites talking about building bows from scratch. So sorry about that. So you were talking about kind of the meditative process of building the bow, and are you mainly making long bows at this point? Have you played much with recurves or laminated recurves or anything like that?
I haven't done anything laminated. Sometimes I recurve my longbows. Just, you know, if, especially if I have a bow that's particularly sluggish, I'll give it a little recurve. But yeah, longbows all, you know, 100%, just wooden bows, just a trunk of a tree.
Nice.
That's my favorite.
Very cool. So tell us a little bit about the Naked and Afraid deal. Like how did those folks reach out to you? How did you get on their radar and tell folks about that experience?
Yeah, well, over the 10 years I spent traveling around, I would stop in at various schools and kind of guest instruct and teach different places. And when the casting company started kind of putting their tentacles out and seeing who was out there, they found me and stalked me on Facebook and sent me a message. And it was kind of game on from there.
Nice, nice. And
Yeah.
did you have any? Did they tell you guys where you were going to go? What type of environment you were going to be in, so that you could prep a little bit ahead of time, or like how? Now you went to Panama, right?
Yes. So my first experience out there was Panama, and then I went to the Peruvian Amazon in, let's see, last November. So the first experience I had, you know, about a week knowing where I was going to go, I kind of got my ticket and was like, oh, okay, I'm, you know, flying into Panama City. Cool. And the second time I actually only had 5 days' notice before I left to go film. So I had no idea that I was going to be brought back. And, they kind of just called and were like, "Hey, what are you doing on Saturday?" I don't know. You tell me.
Do you feel like losing 30 more pounds? How about that?
Exactly. Yeah. Do you want to screw up your whole body again? That'll be great.
So, you know, walk folks through that thing. They, you know, they bring you in, they drop you off. Like what was in to me, kind of the frustrating thing is that these, you know, 21 days of experience gets condensed down to an hour. So there's so much stuff that I think is really, really interesting that ends up just never seeing the light of day. It would be pretty cool if they had just like a ton of B-reel stuff that they would stick online or something like that. But, you know, tell folks what, you know, what it was like. You know, I think something that's really interesting for me is just like figuring out what the priorities are of like getting a camp set up. Like, do you start with shelter first? Do you start with fire first? How long before you start looking for food? You know, what type of tools are you hoping to bring to the thing? Like, walk people through some of that.
Yeah, well, it's the craziest part of it is, you know, you're dropped off and you're naked and you have one item and you're also with this stranger who has their own ideas about how things are going to go. And I think that was one of the craziest things is you go in and you have your idea and they have their idea and then you have to try to reconcile the two and work together as a team on it. And it's intense because it's not only a survival show, it's not only a real survival experience, but it's, you know, it's a television show. So you're going to have to talk to the camera when you want to actually just shut up and build your shelter.
Right.
So yeah, the first thing that I always do is shelter, because you're not going to die immediately from, oh no, this is not working again.
You're good on my side.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
So you're not going to die from hunger immediately. You know, you got a couple of days before you're going to die of dehydration, but you can die in a matter of hours from exposure. You know, if it starts pouring rain, it doesn't matter if it's a beautiful tropical climate. You're going to be in trouble if it's even 70 degrees and pouring rain feels cold. So, shelter's a priority. Definitely, you know, water's going to come up behind that. Fire is occasionally necessary. If you're in a freezing cold climate, that's going to be something you want to get going right away. Or if you need it to purify water, then it's really going to be up there on the list. But shelter's my number one.
And for Panama, how did that all play out versus the second experience that you had, like as far as needing to process water and stay warm and all that type of stuff?
Panama actually was, I think, an easier environment overall, although it was a very challenging experience. Now in retrospect, it was easier. We found water actually on our first day. We were walking towards where we were going to build our little campsite, and we found a spring. So that was amazing. I mean, you find fresh water and you get to drink cold water every day and you don't have to boil your water. I mean, that's pretty luxurious.
Right.
So biggest thing we had a problem with was the fire, and finding the woods that were going to work for the Bodro was very, very difficult. Everything there was like a sponge. It was like trying to light a sponge on fire. And so even the trees that looked like hardwoods, you'd hack into them and they'd have this really talking to you on Skype.
So a much larger challenge was maintaining a internet connection versus starting a fire in the sodden rainforest of Panama. Okay, check.
I feel like a caveman. I'm here, like, hitting my computer.
work, damn it. So, you know, when we did the iCaveman show, it wasn't, I don't think it was as hard to find dry material as what you had, but 2 weeks before we hit that scene outside of Steamboat Springs, everything was under 3 to 4 feet of snow.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So it was pretty wet, and we spent a good 5 hours, I think, just looking. I was pretty paranoid about the whole thing because I've seen people smoke themselves trying to get a fire started. And we had the benefit of having 10 people there. So, like, potentially we could rotate through some people. But I also knew how hard the skill set was. So, I mean, how much time did you spend just prepping versus getting in and actually trying to start the fire?
Well, I mean, by the time the first day was over, you know, we'd thought about fire. We didn't have a lot of time to spend on it. The second day, we just started hitting fire hard, and there was a lot of problems kind of that we had to deal with. I had cut my finger pretty bad within the first couple hours of filming. Mm-hmm. So that was one setback. And then I actually ended up getting stung by a venomous caterpillar on the other hand. So it was one of those things where I felt like I was all thumbs doing it anyway, trying to go out and just get the material. I mean, it was a good couple days work that we spent, and then it just started completely pouring rain, and we honestly didn't even try to start a fire again until day 8, and then we got it. So
wow.
It was one of those things where
no, it's not me, it's you. No. So day 8.
Day 8.
There we were, naked, day 8, the internet wasn't working, and we decided to try fire again.
This is why a computer was not my one item. You cannot count on them.
Right. No, you can count on them to fail right at the time that you need them.
So. Right, exactly.
So to tell me some metrics how hard was food gathering in that environment? Like, people have this sense that the tropics are just flush with food. But sometimes that's not the case.
Right. It's really, I think, anywhere you are, it's about knowing your environment and knowing how to secure that food. And that was the learning curve. That's where that came in. You put someone who's grown up there in that environment, and yeah, they're going to do well because they know exactly where the resources are. But you head into a jungle, and again, you start off with these ideas of thinking that you know something, and that's the biggest mistake, I think. There's just a learning curve. I think it was one of those things where if we'd stuck around, we would have started gaining weight back, because by the end of it, we were actually starting to store food and not be able to eat all the food we were obtaining. But you know, it took about till day 18 to get there. So,
and what were the main, you know, what were the food sources that you had? Like heart of palm, or were you, you were in kind of a tidal area too. So you had some access there. Like what did you start with? What were kind of the first finds, and then where did that subsistence grow into?
So to start off with, our first food was coconut. You know, everyone knows coconut. You're really excited about it. And for the first few days, it's awesome. And then you get horrible diarrhea because you ate too much of it. And, you know, it wipes out your whole system and you never want to touch it again. But no, that was a really great staple to have there. But, you know, everything in moderation. We found this tree called the water apple tree, which was incredible. A lot of water in the fruit as well as sugar, which was great. We had another fruit called the guava, not guava, but guava. And it was these big seed pods. And inside of them, there was a bean. The bean was covered with a white fleshy fruit that happened to taste just like ice cream.
Oh, nice.
Obviously, that was my favorite.
Shocker.
yeah, exactly. And so those were kind of our fruit staples. We had the heart of palm, which was great, although, you know, a little bit energy intensive, but a sure thing once you cut the tree down. And then we had the ocean. So we had snails, which were very tiny, and, you know, it kind of got old smashing snails open and trying to get the tiny little fleck of meat and not eat too much shell.
Right.
Sea urchins, which if you went out diving, you could get a sea urchin. My partner wasn't exactly fond of eating them, but I found them incredible. And lobster, which I ended up catching two of in a lobster trap that I made. And that was like the best thing I've ever eaten in my life, of course.
When I first watched that, I was so stoked for that because I tend to do a lot of lobster, you know, going after them by hand, and then also setting up traps, and then also crayfish. So I was pretty stoked about that.
Yeah. Oh, it was delicious. We actually got two and we couldn't eat them both at the same time. We had to I kind of modified the trap and submerged it in the water so we could go back and get them later, because one of them was a pretty big lobster.
Right.
And then we also got a caiman. There was a bunch of baby caiman, and we kind of learned the best way to get them. So, yeah, if we'd stuck around, it would have started to get a whole lot better.
Right. Just about the time you get your feet under you, they're like, okay, you made it. You're out of here. So.
But the protein is huge. You know, you can, when you have a good protein source, it's huge.
So, you know, were you like in the back of your head, like how important was the whole like kind of optimum foraging strategy deal, you know, where you're thinking about, okay, how much energy am I going to burn going after this versus that? Like, was there much of that discussion going on, or was it just wild flailing trying to find anything that you were slightly higher up the food chain and that was the whole decision process?
Well, I think my partner was a lot more conservative, as far as calorie expenditure.
Mm-hmm.
I learned pretty quick off the bat. I'm a solo hunter. I go out on my own when I am going out hunting and you got, you know, a cameraman following you around. All I'm thinking about is, oh my gosh, everything in the world can hear me coming now. So
right.
I kind of figured that going and trying to hunt and trying to procure something that way wasn't going to be the best option. And I kind of was like, all right, I got to learn how to work this sea because I know there's food just sitting out there. So I was willing to expend the energy for minimal calories, knowing that there was that learning curve and that I would be getting over it. And it worked out for the best, luckily.
Right, right.
But yeah, definitely something to think about for sure.
So now how did that contrast with your second experience? Like what were the food options? Like what was the environment like and easier? You said that the second time was maybe a little harder.
Yeah, definitely. The environment was much more intense. Everything in the Amazon is just so alive and has its own personality. And the rule book pretty much went out the window, and everything I thought I knew about jungle survival, you had to let the Amazon reteach you, because the mosquitoes to start off with were the most intense thing I've ever experienced. I mean, enough to just drive you completely insane. And we had to learn how to deal with those. You'd think, okay, well, we'll light a smoky fire. No. The mosquitoes do not care about the fire there. They are
literally done like 10 shows and had zero internet issues. This is totally amazing.
No, it's me. It's definitely me.
Okay, so the mosquitoes laughed at your attempt at a fire. They just used the soot as a flavoring agent on you guys.
Yes.
What did you figure out that worked?
So we figured out that the best thing to do was to be semi-nomadic. So the more you moved, the less the mosquitoes could congregate. It's like the first night you were there, the mosquitoes were pretty bad. The second night, they were about 10 times worse. Mm. The third night, they were 20 times worse. It was like they would just start inviting their friends over for dinner, and they would just would set up camp with you. And so whenever things would start to get bad, we'd have to move. And
wow.
Staying on the move was the biggest thing. Of course, you're on the move, you have to build new shelters. You have to learn your new environment, because there's so many little, you know, microclimates in the area that we were, that the environments were vastly, vastly different. So, you know, you get one food source that you think is a gimme, and then all of a sudden you're leaving it behind because you're moving to a new area because you're going to go insane with all these mosquitoes. So yeah, it was much more intense that way. But, I think my partner and I really came into the experience with the same goal and the same attitude, and obviously the experience of a first, you know, we had an experience like it before. And so we kind of, you know, had that to go from, and, yeah, it ended up, it was incredibly trying, but, in ways it was easier, I guess.
But the mosquitoes, I tell you, a good mosquito infestation can be an immediate deal breaker for me. Like, I will pack up and I'm like, I am getting the F out of here. I am good.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So, you know, I was thinking about kind of the mental toughness strategy of this stuff. Like, how did you cope with not giving up? Like, what was your internal dialogue and what was going on with that? I get to hang out with some people in like military special forces and different things like that. And I've heard some different coping strategies. Like, what were your coping strategies?
Well, pretty much, you know, going into this, you know that if you assume that production's not going to let you die out there, right?
So
if things get really bad, but you can't focus on the fact that you can quit, because if you focus on the fact you can quit, I feel like you're going to quit. I went into it just, I'm finishing this no matter what. If they drag me out of here in a body bag, and I'm not quitting. There's nothing that's going to make me give up. And just not having that out as an option, you're going to do as good as you can do. I feel like the greater the need, the greater the result. And so when you need to get out of something, you're going to get out of it. And I don't know, I think I'm an optimist in general. So even when things were really bad, EJ and I would be down by the river swatting mosquitoes, just, you know, in the throes of torture. And we'd look up at the sky and there would be a million stars and there'd be fireflies all around us and there'd be lightning on either side of us, but it would be clear above us. And we'd look at each other and we'd go, you know what? This isn't half bad. Like,
right.
This is cool. Like, who gets to do this? You know?
Right.
So there was that too.
It's interesting for me. I think I had a little bit of the steely resolve, but I actually, and this is something that's interesting, I use the, I'm not going to give up right now, but at noon I'll give up. I'm going home at noon. And then I would get to noon and then I'm like, ah, fuck it. I'll stay here until 4 o'clock. And so, you know, I had a little bit of both of those where it's like in the back of my head, I'm like, I'm not giving up. But then part of the immediate, that was kind of like the long-term kind of anchor. But the more immediate thing, I was like, yeah, I'll just go for 4 more hours and then I'll bail. I can bail anytime. And so
that's how I get through most of my CrossFit workouts.
Okay. Perfect. Perfect. So yeah.
But I mean, I think, you know, another part of it is just the fact that being out there is so incredible and you so fully experience every single second you're out there, even if it's not, you know, a fun situation, you're experiencing it to such an extent that it just makes it amazing in its own way. You know, you can kill 3 hours on Facebook and not remember a single thing you did, but I remember every second that I was out in these 21 day experiences, and that's, knowing that, it's an awesome feeling.
So what's it like coming back after that? What was your experience coming back to like real life after that?
That's the worst. I mean, to be honest with you, after coming back from the first experience, I got a little depressed. It was like, how could anything be so exciting? And so when you know, I try to live my life in an adventurous way. I think when I came back, I wanted to kind of put all that energy into a business and kind of almost settled down. And then the other opportunity came up and I just absolutely leaped at it. I was just ecstatic that I was going to be going out again. And, you know, I try to just keep the ball rolling as far as what I'm doing and adventure. I think, you know, the hardest part beyond that of coming back was the effect that it has on your body, which, to have control and not throw my computer off.
Oh well, it's all good stuff. So that's why I set the bar purposefully low on this show. Then there's nowhere to go but up. So you're good. So you were talking about the effect that this experience has on your body. Like what was the effect?
Yeah, it's a really intense hormonal effect. I think it's when females especially go through the experience, it changes just your whole, any hormone level, whatever you have going on, your body kind of goes into the survival state. And coming back, I think the biggest thing I noticed was I'm usually really fit. Trying to put muscle back on when you return is incredibly difficult. Your body wants to take everything and store it as fat because it doesn't know if you're going to get thrown back out there again, you know,
right.
And it, you know, muscle burns more calories than fat. So I feel like going into these situations, it wants to have fat. It wants to be storing fat. So, it's interesting and it takes time. And I've learned the best way to deal with it is just being patient and not trying to, you know, I tried to push myself the first time and I ended up, hurting my back for the first time ever, in a workout. So that was
a
mistake, but, yeah. So it's just like letting go of those expectations and being patient with your body. And, yeah, it was pretty intense.
I was definitely smoked after my gig. Like I lost a lot of weight. Definitely feel like I had some cortisol and thyroid stuff going on for a while. And it took a good chunk of time to get the wheels back on the wagon. So I could fully believe that. And that's where it's kind of surprised me that several of you whippersnappers have gotten out there and done back-to-backers on this stuff. I'm like, clearly I am getting old and beat down because I would
no
I would
you just
have done
take
that.
Care of your body. I'm really cruel to my body.
Man, so you know, what would you, if you had say like a list of like 3 to 5 survival skills that you feel like everybody should have some aptitude with, you know, how would you order that stuff out? And I know it's going to change enormously, whether we're talking about like a desert environment versus like an alpine environment and stuff like that. But what are some things that you feel like everybody should have some steeping in?
Well, I feel like the first is really kind of more of a mental preparedness thing. I feel like in our culture, we don't remember how to meet our own. We don't know what our basic needs are. So we don't know how to meet them. So we have kind of our basic needs met by, you know, all these systems around us. And when you talk to someone, they think the first thing to address in a survival situation, they're worried about food, you know, because who wants to miss a meal? That sucks. But I think it's really putting everything into perspective and really relearning what it takes to keep you alive and understanding what order to put things in. So I think that is huge. I think that knowing the basics of starting a fire, I mean, I've met a lot of people who've never even started a fire with, you know, a lighter, just a lighter before.
Right.
So knowing how to do that in any environment and understanding the most base, even if you don't know friction fire, just the most basics of starting a fire, that's huge. And yeah, I feel like honestly, when you know those two things and you're able and willing to adapt, once you get out into a situation, you can kind of look around, and once you know what your needs are, you can kind of figure out through your adaptability how to meet them. I mean, you don't have to know what every single plant is. You don't have to know all your materials on a firsthand basis. That obviously helps to a huge extent. But if you're in a, you know, you get dropped off in a jungle, you might not know what exactly you're touching. Hopefully, you know, it's not one of the many species of poisonous plants, but you see the tree with the big leaves and it's kind of instinct. Okay, well, I'm going to make a shelter out of that. That
right.
Kind of.
Very cool. So what are you doing to help people learn about all this type of stuff?
Yeah. So beyond, you know, hopefully sharing my experience and adventures more in a, you know, with media, I'm all about teaching workshops and I'm sitting on the router looking at it and
So you offer workshops in how to dismantle routers and throw computers against the wall. What else do you offer?
Yeah, that scene from Office Space where they're just like smashing all the electronics. That's what I want to do right now.
Soon, soon. I'm telling you, technology is the root of all evil. So we'll just use it to our best benefit, but not let it kill us.
Sounds good. But yeah, teaching and sharing what I do is really important to me.
So where do folks find you for that stuff? And like what type of programs are you offering and that type of stuff?
Well, I'm on the road. I'm doing a little bit of filming still. So I don't have any workshops currently, but laurazara.com is my website. And I really keep that up to date with whatever I'm doing. If I'm going through a town and I'm going to have a workshop or give a speech or something like that, then I keep everything posted and on there. Also on my Facebook fan page, which is just Laura Zara, and then Twitter at Laura Zara. I try to keep everything updated so that whatever means people follow me by, they can kind of stay up to date.
Fantastic. Well, cool. Well, so that we don't kill your computer or router or anything, we'll cut this one at about 40 minutes, but I was super stoked to have you on. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. So,
thank you so much, Rob. It was an honor to be on your show.
Huge honor having you on. And whenever you have something happening, please ping me so that I can get that out on my Facebook and Twitter feed so that folks know about it.
Definitely. Will do. And I'll let you know when I'm up for some atlatl practice.
Anytime. We've got a place for you to stay, and there's lots of critters to stalk around Reno. Oddly enough, there's quite a bit of varmint around here. So
awesome. Well, thanks again.
Awesome, Laura. Talk to you soon.
Take care.
Okay, bye. Bye-bye.